From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. This is a perilous time for frontline journalists. Just this month, two reporters from American publications were imprisoned in Iran, two American reporters were sentenced to 12 years hard labor in North Korea, and a New York Times reporter escaped from the Taliban, who had kidnapped him. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Chris Kramer about his efforts to keep frontline journalists safe. Kramer is president of the International News Safety Institute, former president of CNN International, and former head of news gathering at the BBC. His commitment to keeping frontline journalists safe developed after he was taken hostage at the Iranian embassy in London. We'll also talk about the psychological hazards of covering war with psychiatrist Anthony Feinstein. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This has been a perilous month for frontline journalists. Iran has cracked down on reporters trying to cover the protests. Among the journalists in prison are reporters for Newsweek and The Washington Times. Two American journalists were sentenced to 12 years of hard labor in North Korea. Also this month, New York Times reporter David Rode escaped from the Taliban, who had kidnapped him last November. Later, we're going to hear from a psychiatrist who has studied the psychological hazards of covering war and offers treatment to frontline journalists. Our first guest, Chris Kramer, has spent much of his career sending journalists into hot zones and trying to keep them safe. As we'll hear, his interest in protecting journalists developed after he was taken hostage while on assignment. Kramer is former head of news gathering at the BBC and former president of CNN International. He's now the global editor of multimedia for Reuters and president of the International News Safety Institute. Chris Kramer, welcome to Fresh Air. What's been going through your mind about what frontline journalists are facing now?
Well, I think we've seen a trend in the last maybe 5, 10, 15 years where more of your colleagues and my colleagues are potentially in harm's way than ever before. And I include indigenous journalists, those who report on the countries they live in, and those who travel in from the US or Europe. And I put them all in one category. Something's going on out there at the moment. Our industry is in peril. Some dreadful statistics in the last 10, 12 years, something like well in excess of 1,000 media workers, and by that I mean people who report on the stories and those who support them, whether it's translators or interpreters or drivers or producers or cameramen, they are very much in harm's way. It's not possible any longer to behave as though you're in a bubble, to cruise from one side to another in a hostile zone. We're being targeted, we're being imprisoned, we're being harassed, we're being assaulted, and sometimes, and all too frequently, we're being murdered.
Now, let me back up before we talk more about what you've been trying to do to help journalists in war zones. Let me back up to the, I think, precipitating story in your life that got you headed in that direction. And this goes back to 1980, when you were briefly held hostage. Would you tell us that story?
Yes, I was a producer, television producer for the BBC based in London, at the end of April 1980, I was asked by the BBC to get a visa to go and cover the hostage crisis, the American hostage crisis in Tehran, where, if you recall, a large number of U.S. Diplomats and other folk had been taken hostage by the Republican Guards. And the only way I was able to get a visa, because I couldn't do it on the phone or in writing and in correspondence, was to take myself to the Iranian embassy in London. I was actually only in the embassy for about 10 or 15 minutes when it was stormed by a number of gunmen who I subsequently discovered were Iranian dissidents. And they took both myself and 25 other people hostage for a period of 6 days before Margaret Thatcher, the Prime Minister in Britain, sent in the special forces, the SAS, to break the siege. I actually only lasted, if you like, for a day and a half before it was pretty clear to me that I had a horrible instinct that it was going to end very unpleasantly. My journalistic instincts, in fact, really sort of died on me in the first 12 hours. I did telex some information to the outside world and then set up an interview between the leader of the terrorists and the BBC. But during the night, or the first night, my kind of journalistic instincts sort of quietly went to sleep, really. And my own personal instincts kicked in, and I had this horrible foreboding that it was going to end extremely unpleasantly, and particularly for me. So the mind is a great vehicle, and overnight something happened to me. I became, to myself, extremely unwell very, very quickly. And by the noon of the next day, I had, if you like, begun to shut down physically. So the gunmen were convinced that I was having a heart attack or something worse than that, or something slightly this side of that. So was rather unceremoniously dumped onto the sidewalk outside the embassy. And for the next few days, actually was able to work with the authorities. In fact, I didn't realize it was the special forces. I just thought it was the police. to you know, towards the siege being concluded, I guess, about 4 days later. I'm telling you all of that for the following reason, you know, not because I have a victim syndrome here, but because I was very tempted to leave the profession after that. It was very clear to me that if I couldn't, if you like, continue to go to war, there was nothing else for me. I turned down psychiatric counseling. The BBC were kind enough to offer it twice. I didn't want to admit to myself, and I didn't want to admit to my managers that if you'd like, I'd lost my nerve.
Let me just stop you here. I just want to back up a second. You said your journalistic instincts died after you were taken hostage. They remained for a few hours, and then they just kind of died. If they were functioning properly in your mind, what would you have been doing compared to what happened?
Terry, I think some people listening to this broadcast would automatically assume, as I did, that this was the scoop of a lifetime. You know, I found myself inside a horrible hostage situation, you know, with the appalling irony that I was there to go and cover something equally unpleasant happening in Tehran. So this was my golden opportunity to shine. I could have done a variety of things, and I've rehearsed it in my mind 1,000 times since. You know, I could have secured the release of 26 hostages. I could have anything from the range of single-handedly overpowering the gunman to, you know, to getting a Pulitzer Prize or whatever the British equivalent would be. But that's not what I did. It's not what I wanted to do after a very short period of time. It is almost impossible to explain to someone what it feels like to have, you know, a young person, many years younger than yourself, pointing a gun directly at your head, and in his left hand having a hand grenade, which he ostentatiously takes the pin out, in, out, in, out, over a period of 15 or 20 minutes. That is almost impossible to explain. Many people react in a completely different way to it. To me, it was the most single terrifying thing of my entire life, and I never want to repeat it or come close to repeating it. So when I talk about my journalistic instincts closing down, you know, very good friends of mine have said, well, didn't you realize you had the capacity to own the scoop of the century here? And I said, yes, but frankly, survival was much more important to me. So I have absolutely no regrets about that at all.
So you said your body shut down. Was your body shutting down out of fear? Do you have any idea what was going on in your body?
Yes, it was shutting down because of panic. It was shutting down because of fear. It was shutting down. My systems, I believe, were closing down because I was determined that flight should kick in. And you know what? I mean, I'm still have mixed emotions as to whether or not I really was ill or wasn't. Although the moment I was put into an ambulance and outside the embassy, and they tried to put an oxygen mask over my face and tried to inject me with something or other, I tore the mask off my face and said, stop the ambulance now. If you're going to storm the embassy, I need to tell you some things. For example, I need to tell you there are 6 gunmen in there. And they said, no, there are 2. I said, no, take it from me. I've counted them. There are 6. And they are extremely heavily armed, and they have explosives, and they are going to kill hostages. And the person in the back of the ambulance, who, as it turned out, was a member of the Special Forces, and I thought he was an ambulance worker, screamed to the driver to stop the ambulance, and he burst out of the back door and left me in the ambulance, back of the ambulance by myself, because he went off to tell them, you know, that piece of information, which I happen to think was crucial, because I do believe they were going to storm the embassy.
Were there people in the embassy who were killed?
Yes. About 3 days after I was released, so day 5, I guess, or maybe into day 6 of the siege, they had threatened to kill a hostage every hour unless their demands, which are rather vague at this distance, but they certainly wanted a number of their, you know, colleagues back in part of Iran released, and they wanted the usual plane to the airport and all of that stuff, and threatened to kill a hostage one every hour if their demands were not met. And they executed one hostage, threatened to execute a second one. At that point, Margaret Thatcher deployed the SAS into the building, you know, around lunchtime on the 6th day.
And were people killed during that part?
Yes, the gunman sprayed the room where most of the hostages were kept, and they killed one. They seriously injured 2 or 3 others. The SAS killed 5 of the 6 terrorists, and one of the terrorists actually, you know, infiltrated himself into the hostages and managed to get out of the building. And I suspect if he had not done that, he would have been the 6th one killed. And he was subsequently tried, and I gave evidence at his trial at the Old Bailey. And he was jailed for life, and I think released last year, actually.
So did you ever write this up as a story?
No, not for me. I mean, I did with a BBC sound recordist who was there until the end. He and I co-wrote a book, which, frankly, was not a journalistic exercise. And, you know, I know now what a cathartic exercise is. It was a downloading for me of a number of anxieties and you know, and feelings of guilt and all of that stuff. And it was more about that than wanting to document it. And the book was published about a year later and was a resounding failure as a book. But but it was a useful exercise for me, and I'm not sure what his motives were. But no, I'd never wrote it up as a story. I was interviewed, clearly. I had a duty to my employers, the BBC, so obviously made myself available for interviews immediately after the siege ended and subsequently after that. But I don't regard that as a journalistic part of my life. I regard it as a crossroads in my life because it convinced me that covering wars was not for me, and if I wanted to stay in the business, I had to, you know, choose another path, which, as it turned out, was, you know, worked out fairly well for me because I, you know, went into middle management and then senior management.
My guest is Chris Kramer, president of the International News Safety Institute and former president of CNN International. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Chris Kramer, president of the International News Safety Institute and former president of CNN International. He went into management after the experience of being held hostage by Iranians left him too traumatized to be a war correspondent. How did you feel when you went into management, sending journalists into war zones, because that was part of your job, handling international news, knowing that you felt you couldn't handle that yourself, that you felt you had failed when, you know, the grenade was in front of your face and the gun was pointed to your head?
If I had known then what I know now, I would have realized that the most intelligent thing I could have done was to instantly go off and see a psychiatrist, because, you know, I know now that I had a form of post-traumatic stress disorder, which lasted for many years and manifested it. I mean, it didn't have a fancy label in those days. But it, you know, it went down the traditional path of stress that we know about these days, which is, you know, nightmares, claustrophobia, not being able to fly, not being able to actually go in elevators or even escalators, not being comfortable sitting in a room unless I was having my back to the door, not going to theaters or restaurants for a very long period of time. All now I know to be classic, if you like, signs of a form of PTSD. So my early few years in middle management, I had the utmost respect and indeed was in awe of people that I assigned to war zones, but was still processing this stuff myself. It made me much more protective of my staff. And as I, you know, if you like, went up the, you know, greasy pole of management, I did find myself in a position of being able to influence the way in which people were sent into war zones. And, you know, I think was able to, if you like, do a little bit of intellectual payback and to make sure that on my watch, people would get the very best of care and would get the very best of attention, whether it was the best training or the best equipment or the best vehicles to drive. And, you know, in the mid-80s, late 80s, this was pretty unconventional stuff, even at a big, well-funded, mature organization like the BBC. I mean, I think many of my staff thought I was pretty weird.
But the advice you were giving was for their safety. So what was some of the advice you were giving, and what were some of the systems you were setting up early on with the intention of protecting the journalists you were sending into war zones?
Well, I guess, I mean, I can focus on, I think, the siege of Dubrovnik, which I think it was in 1991, when, if you remember, Dubrovnik was under siege. The BBC crew there made the very intelligent assessment that if they were going to stay, they could well get killed. So they informed me as the, whatever I was then, you know, foreign editor or assistant foreign editor, that they were pulling out. And my first response was sort of anger, really, that, you know, how could they do this? Because that would undoubtedly mean that we would not be able to, you know, get those wonderful awards that you get at journalistic, you know, annual journalistic awards. But that passed very quickly, and I was disgusted by that emotion. And I said, how dare you, how dare I behave like this? So really, myself and a number of colleagues took it upon ourselves to draw up some pretty simple guidelines about safety guidelines, you know, with the opening headline that no story is worth a life. No picture sequence or audio sequence is worth a serious injury. There's always another day to do this story. Now, that simple, bold, declarative sentence that no story is worth a life was unbelievably controversial at the BBC.
And why?
Because there were many people, not just in the BBC, but in the industry in Britain, who thought that somehow undermined and belittled the job of a journalist. I mean, you know, my own view then, and even more forcefully now, is I'm not belittling what you do. What I'm saying to you is there's always another, you know, you can drive down that road tomorrow or the next day. You don't have to go in headlong pursuit of a story and disregard your own life or those of the colleagues you're working with. And I think it's sort of ironic that the phrase no story is worth a life is, I actually frequently hear it played back to myself by other people in other contexts. And it's not that I'm proud of the phrase, but I'm just, what makes me smile is, you know, nearly 20 years ago now, it was considered heresy to say that. My view is that it was part of a process of the media industry growing up. People who fight fires, you know, don't go off to fight fires without the most profound training and equipment and guidance and support before, during, and after that particular incident. Members of the armed forces, both here in the US and overseas, now regard all of this stuff as par for the course. You don't go and do this until you're, unless you're well trained and well rehearsed and well prepped on what you might, you know, what you might confront when you do what you do. And yet the media profession, until fairly recently, and pockets of the media profession still, seem to think that they can drift in and out of war zones, you know, without any harm coming to them. Life's not like that. It certainly isn't like that anymore.
What kind of training do you try to provide journalists now before sending them into a war zone?
We worked with a security company, and you know, there's a large number of these security companies now around the place, and designed, I think, to begin with a three-day course and then a four-day course, and it's now mostly a week's course. And it's standard fare for the industry, you know, CNN, BBC, Reuters, Associated Press, you know, many distinguished U.S. newspapers, NPR, for journalists or those who work with them to go off on these, what they call hostile environment courses, and they're mostly residential. And they cover a variety of pieces of roadcraft, if you like, all the way through from the, you know, the grisly part of, you know, what weapons do to bodies, all the way through to how to evade and avoid being taken hostage, how to behave if you are taken hostage, all the way through to crucially, to very, very, very advanced first aid, battlefield first aid. And many of my colleagues around the world have actually had cause to use that. Alan Johnson, a distinguished BBC correspondent, taken hostage in Gaza. He went on one of these hostile environment courses, and there is a, you know, a pretty unpleasant experience where they put a black bag over your head, and he'd heard this was going to happen, and in other words, he was braced for it. And the instructor said to him, Alan, the next time this happens, it's going to be for real. You know, fast forward a few months, and that's exactly what happened to him in Gaza. So there's role playing. It's of course all an exercise. It's not real, but it prepares you for a variety of things that might happen to you when you're you know, covering something overseas or even in your own country.
Now, you know, you came up with that phrase, no story is worth a life. But in your position, you have sent many journalists into war zones. And of course, the way to make sure that a journalist isn't killed in war is to not go into the war zone in the first place. So I'm sure that there have been times for you when it's been difficult to decide whether the situation was too risky to even send a journalist there. And I'm wondering if you could give us an example of a situation like that. Where was it a very difficult judgment call for you?
Well, I mean, I think there have been tricky judgment calls down the years. And, you know, I have, in a variety of different forms, if you like, been assigning people to potentially unpleasant or known unpleasant parts of the world, you know, both at the BBC and CNN and now at Reuters. And I think there are some parts of the world where I'm, you know, profoundly uncomfortable about sending people ever. And, you know, Somalia is one that comes to mind. You know, Somalia is a killing zone for journalists. Plenty of examples of that. At various times down the years, I have had a prevailing view that we should not go. And you know what? What I don't believe in, and what tends to make me very irritated, is the notion that, oh, well, don't you understand, the journalist on the spot should really make that judgment for him or herself. And I don't accept that. I think it, you know, I think this is a partnership. I think journalists and those who work with them around the world frequently have most of the data. But at the end of the day, it's a management call. It's about the safety of our staff. If we say that our most valuable resource are our staff, then we need to behave as though that's true, which means on occasions we will not go to certain parts of the world, which is unfortunate. But, you know, it does not mean we never go there. It means that circumstances might change and we can go there maybe later, or we can send fewer people there. But I think this has been the healthy part of the debate, that it's not at all unusual now for, you know, very sophisticated safety plans to go in front of management, you know, middle management or senior management, and be assessed against the following equation. What's the risk versus the reward here? What's the journalistic reward? You know, can we maybe do it next week or next year as opposed to tomorrow?
Chris Kramer will be back in the second half of the show. He's the president of the International News Safety Institute and former president of CNN International. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals, from doctors and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. From the Annie E. Casey Foundation, working to help vulnerable kids, families, and communities succeed at aecf.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the psychological hazards of covering war. We talk with psychiatrist Anthony Feinstein, who has written a study of war correspondents and has treated war correspondents for stress-related problems. And Chris Kramer talks about what it's like to lose a colleague in a war zone. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Chris Kramer. We're talking about his efforts to keep journalists in war zones safe. He's the former president of CNN International and former head of news gathering for the BBC. He's now president of the International News Safety Institute and global editor of multimedia for Reuters. When we left off, we were talking about how news organizations need to weigh the journalistic benefits of sending a reporter into a war zone with the risks that journalist will face. How did you do the risk versus reward equation when the United States invaded Baghdad? and you had to decide who was going to be in Baghdad, where were they going to be?
Well, I think at the time, actually, the decision was sort of taken out of my hands, really, because the Iraqis threw the CNN correspondent and the staff out of Baghdad, before. Just, I mean, they had been there for a very long time, and then they were, if you like, sort of thrown out. But, I mean, to your general point, I mean, obviously, both in Gulf War I and Gulf War II, it was obvious that a large number of journalists were going to be in harm's way. And so very sophisticated training, or in fact retraining in many cases, was put in place. In my last few years at CNN, I worked on the basic principle that, and this is going to sound like catch 22, and so, you know, it is a catch 22. I would work on the principle that no one from CNN would be assigned to Iraq if they hadn't been to Iraq before. And what I was saying is that it was not a kindergarten for enthusiastic journalists, that unless they had worked in that country and knew, some of the risks, indeed all of the risks that they were taking, it wasn't fair on the rest of the staff in Iraq. And clearly the CNN, then had, I guess, 60 or 70 people there, maybe rather fewer, many fewer these days. But my view was that it wasn't a place for, newbies, that when things got a little safer, as they have done in recent months and years, maybe it's a time for newbies to get there, if you like, to go off and do their thing. But that was pretty controversial at CNN, and the view that people couldn't go unless they'd been there before. And I have no regrets about that at all. It was the right call at that particular time.
Have you lost journalists at war?
Yes, rather more than I care to remind myself, though I can tell you it's 7 journalists and those who work with them, certainly on my watch, both at the BBC and at CNN. 7, colleagues of mine, some of whom I knew well, some of whom I didn't, have died in a variety of war zones, and that tears a part of my soul away.
I'm sure it does. Would you tell us the story of one of those deaths and perhaps a lesson that you learned from it that changed your personal guidelines of how to deal with journalists in combat zones?
Yes, I guess we're talking 2006 now. A CNN crew, in fact, in 2 vehicles, was driving in Iraq, and CNN has for some considerable time had a policy of having armed protection, and that's pretty controversial for some people. There were 2 vehicles, and there was a correspondent and cameraman with a driver and a security assistant who was armed, and 2 local staff in a vehicle behind, and the vehicle behind, well, the convoy of the 2 vehicles was attacked by a couple of vehicles. The first vehicle with the correspondent, in fact, was Michael Holmes, who's still working at CNN. They came under attack. The armed escort fired back, and they very, very, very narrowly escaped death. Got to somewhere safe, and then realized that the second vehicle was not following them. So it transpired that the 2 CNN employees who were in the second vehicle had been murdered.
And what impact did that have on how you send journalists into war zones?
Well, in that particular case, I mean, there has been a debate for a few years now, that has the industry crossed the line by having hired guns to look after us. My view is, and this is going to sound callous, and so be it, I will do anything to protect the people who work with me and for me, short of insisting that they carry weapons themselves, which that notion of that I abhor. I don't think there's any occasion where a journalist should be armed, unless possibly if he or she is called upon to protect themselves in some situation that it's pointless to speculate about. But I will do anything to protect staff, and that has meant authorizing extremely large budgets for armed protection in Iraq, Somalia, and other parts of the world, Afghanistan. I think that particular incident that I've recounted reinforced my notion that the line in the sand is moving the whole time. The situation has changed down the years now. I mean, someone, very dear to me at CNN said it reminded him of the story of the frog in the boiling water, that, you know, the water is gently turned up the whole time. At what point does the frog realize that if he doesn't jump, he's going to be boiled to death? That, I think, perfectly describes many situations around the world where, you know, journalistic colleagues of yours or mine are covering stories where they are not the best judge of the risks that's going on around them. That means that managers have to have the responsibility to, you know, close an operation down, instruct their staff out, and shut off the line of communication and information flow, which is awful, but doesn't need to be permanent.
Have you ever pulled a journalist out of a war zone because you felt that he or she was having problems that they might not even have recognized themselves because they're so committed to doing the job and continuing to report on the story?
It's a really tricky territory. The answer is yes, but not quite as abruptly as you phrased it. I mean, I'm passionate in the view that journalists and their colleagues don't need to prove themselves time after time after time. And I have on several occasions said to them quietly and privately, you know what, Harriet, you can sit out the next one. You don't have to go and do it. And certainly I've had conversations with the people in the field in recent years where I've said, you know what, I think it's time maybe for you to take a bit of a rest. You know, have I ever instructed someone to drive to the airport? No, because it hasn't come to that, because I think most people you sort of get it these days, and the stubborn ones down the years, you know, have enough friends who care for them to, you know, make it pretty clear to them that it's time to take a rest. This is a really tricky balancing act between caring management as opposed to just management and passionate journalists who are determined to continue to cover the story because they care, because they want to make a difference, not because they want the next promotion. Most of the people that I'm talking about are, you know, are at the top of their profession.
It sounds like you are providing the best support that you can to the journalists you're sending out, and you've tried doing that at the BBC, at CNN, and now at Reuters, and through your work as the president of the International News Safety Institute. At the same time, as news organizations shut down foreign bureaus, it seems to me we're relying more and more on freelance correspondents to go to those war zones and bring back the stories. And freelance journalists don't have that kind of support network that CNN or Reuters or the BBC or the New York Times or NPR can provide. And I wonder if you agree that there are more freelancers out there now and what your concerns are for them.
No, it is a fact that, you know, because of this economic turndown, that much of the frontline, you know, news reporting for many organizations is now being, you know, being done by freelancers, certainly by indigenous journalists who live in country. But I'm you know, pretty dogmatic about this, and, you know, have expressed this view at all the organizations that I work for, and have expressed this view, you know, certainly, you know, on behalf of the International News Safety Institute. I draw no distinction, Terry, between staff and freelancers, and I draw no distinction when it comes to training, when it comes to proper equipment, and when it comes to counseling and emotional support, you know, before, during, and after a story. And, you know, frankly, I have little patience for those news managers who think that somehow we can get our international news reportage done on the cheap, you know, by freelancers. I can't accept that. Clearly, it's more difficult logistically to ensure that freelancers get trained and, crucially, insured. You know, once again, I'm very dogmatic on this. There has to be an insurance scheme for freelancers. Reputable news organizations do that.
Are you talking about health insurance, or is there insurance that goes even beyond that?
I'm talking about should they be harmed. I'm talking about life insurance.
Life insurance.
I'm saying that we should not, as a profession, be asking, you know, people to go off in our name and provide reporting for us unless we give them, afford them the same level of protection that we afford our staff. And that certainly, you know, was the case at CNN, is the case in Reuters, and I know to be the case at the BBC. And I think that's the right attitude. You know, the horrible statistic is, and you put your finger on it, that 90% of all journalists who are dying around the world at the moment doing their jobs are local journalists, are not ones who fly in and fly out again. They're people who live there, speak the language, were brought up there. And, you know, 9 out of 10 of every one of your and my colleagues who die actually are dying in their own countries.
Now, you said after you were taken hostage at the Iranian embassy in London, that when you managed to get out, you were offered counseling, which you declined to accept, but that you later came to regret that because you realized that for quite a long time you suffered with some of the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, which wasn't named that yet. So is counseling one of the things you offer journalists in the field or when they come out of a war zone?
Yes, I mean, certainly the three organizations that I've worked for down the years, and many, many more now, have a variety of support systems for staff, all the way through, you know, safety training ahead of an assignment to appropriate equipment to wear and all of that stuff, and also the ability, should they wish to, take it up to contact or meet, you know, a counselor. And for me, it's no more a matter of routine than you come back from an overseas assignment and you do your laundry. Well, I regard this as doing your head laundry. Many of my colleagues, you know, tend to rely on extremely close relationships with partners or family or friends or colleagues. And some choose to go off and talk or pick up the phone to a professional counselor. And certainly, I have experience of close friends at CNN and the BBC who have volunteered to me, because it's nothing to do with me as their manager, that it's just routine stuff for them now. They pick up the phone, they go and see someone. It's as obvious and as automatic as just, you know, putting their laundry in the laundromat.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
All right, Terry, I thoroughly enjoyed it. It's a pleasure to hear your voice.
Chris Kramer is the president of the International News Safety Institute and global editor of multimedia for Reuters. Coming up, psychiatrist Anthony Feinstein discusses the psychological hazards of covering war. Feinstein's book is dedicated to Chris Kramer. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Anthony Feinstein, is a psychiatrist who wrote a book about the psychological hazards of covering war called Journalists Under Fire. He's treated war correspondents and created a website to help journalists in war zones diagnose and deal with their stress-related problems. Dr. Feinstein is a professor of psychiatry at the University of Toronto. Dr. Feinstein, welcome to Fresh Air. A lot of soldiers, when they come home, don't like to talk about what they've seen in war. And they don't want to dwell on those memories. When you're a journalist, it's your job to remember. It's your job to get every detail that you can remember and report it. And then that report lives. That report, you know, lives in print or on the internet, in video, whatever. And chances are somebody's going to ask you about it too. I mean, you might even become famous for this report and end up being interviewed about what you've seen. And the memories will come out again. So is it harder sometimes for journalists to deal with the memories that can cause post-traumatic stress because it's their job to report it?
I think it can. And I think you're touching a really interesting point over here, which is this. One of the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder is what we term avoidant behavior, that you want to stay away from reminders or recollections of the traumatic event. And this is where journalists who have the syndrome, who have PTSD, find themselves in a unique conundrum because their physiology is telling them to stay away from it, but they can't because they're journalists. They often have to go back to that particular scene and get the news, get the story. And this puts them in a unique bind, and I think it's a very difficult bind for journalists to reconcile because there's the professional demands. They want to be able to, you know, tell the story and keep the newsroom happy, but at the same time, the physiology is giving them a warning sign that they should back off from this. This is very uncomfortable for them.
I think it must be hard sometimes for war correspondents to know when is it time to come out. When have you taken too many risks? When are you just too worn out from the risks that you've exposed yourself to and the things that you've witnessed? And if you're a dedicated war correspondent, it must be very difficult to give that up for a lot of reasons. As one, you're kind of working at the center of history and recording it. And two, I think a lot of war correspondents become so committed to understanding and translating the war or disaster or calamity that they're witnessing, and they don't want to leave the story because they've come to care about it so deeply. Have you worked with correspondents in helping them figure out when it's time to give it up?
I found that the journalists that I've worked with, who are for the most part very experienced, have figured this out themselves often. They know that they have a certain limit of time that they can spend in the front lines, and then they need to take a break from it. And so they tend to follow that. Many of the journalists have said to me they spend about 6 weeks, 2 months, and then they know that they need to take a break from it before they come back and continue their work. So to many of them, they seem to have sorted out their own way of dealing with this. I think what's often been much more difficult is for a journalist to decide to leave a particular conflict altogether and go and do something else. Because as you point out, their investment in the story is often extremely intense, and they may not necessarily have become emotionally involved in what they're doing. Many of them don't, but they still are attached to the power of the event that they've been reporting, and it's very hard to walk away from that. In addition, they have made often very intense friendships or established strong bonds with local journalists or fixers whom they often feel a moral responsibility for. So situations that I've counted in Iraq, for example, as journalists, Western journalists, have gone into work there. They've done some wonderful work. They've established excellent contacts with Iraqi fixers who've helped them. But then the journalists start feeling responsible for their fixers because they realize that if they leave the story or they come back to home, this journalist might be unemployed, they may be in some financial difficulty. And so they have this kind of obligation that they feel they need to fulfill to people who've helped them and allowed them to get the story and allowed them to do the work. And that can be very difficult because guilt then starts playing a prominent part in their decision-making process. And that's not a healthy thing. You don't want your decisions to be driven primarily by guilt. And so that's something that certainly crops up in the therapy that I do.
I know you've spoken with some journalists who have a close friend, a colleague, or somebody who they met in a war zone who died. And sometimes they even feel partly responsible or guilty about the death. Is there a story about that you helped somebody through that you could tell us without necessarily mentioning the name of the person?
I think from a clinical perspective, it's been my experience that this is the hardest thing to deal with, that from time to time I've had a journalist referred who has lost a colleague in the field, and the journalist holds himself responsible for the person's death. And then the guilt becomes extremely powerful and overwhelming. And as part of the guilt, the journalist often wishes that it had been he or she who had died and not their friend. That speaks to the intensity of their guilt. And this becomes a very difficult clinical situation to deal with. What I often do in situations like that is that I check for an underlying depression, and if that's present, I treat that. But then what I have to do with the journalist is to correct the distortion that has crept into the person's thinking in relation to their guilt and the blame. And that can be a very challenging task. I've found also that the presence of prominent guilt in the death of a colleague is the single biggest catalyst that triggers a often significant depressive disorder in journalists. So it's a pressing clinical issue. I think the most dramatic account of this was given to me by the Italian journalist Giuliana Scrana. I don't know if you remember the episode. It took place in Iraq back, I believe, in 2005. Giuliana Scrana is a journalist who works for Il Manifesto, and she's by nature a pacifist, but had gone to Iraq repeatedly to tell the story of the human cost of war. And while she was there, she was kidnapped, held captive for a month. Her video was posted. It was a very distressing sight to see her pleading for her release. There was a real concern that she would be killed by her captors. Eventually, she was released. The Italian government sent a security man to broker her release, which he did. And en route to the airport, their car came under fire mistakenly from American soldiers, and Juliana Skrenna was injured, but the security man shielded her from the incoming fire, and he was killed. And it was just this remarkable confluence of events that her moment of release and freedom had been blighted by this event that took the life of the man who had come to secure her freedom. And she described to me very vividly what it was like to feel this man literally breathe his last on top of her and to feel his body go limp as he died. And these were the memories that she'd been left with in terms of her moment of freedom. And, you know, the guilt in response to something like that is extremely powerful.
My guest is psychiatrist Anthony Feinstein. We'll talk more about his work with journalists who cover war after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is psychiatrist Anthony Feinstein. He wrote a book about the psychological hazards of reporting on war, and he's treated journalists who work in war zones. Is it still difficult for journalists to admit that they're having problems as a result of covering wars because they're afraid that their news organization will think that that they just don't have the guts to do it anymore, or that they have to be rotated out, you know, that they're not very good?
Yeah. I think the answer is yes. I think for some journalists, it's very difficult to admit to that. There's no doubt that there's still a stigma surrounding issues of psychology and mental health, and some journalists are very uncomfortable with this notion, and they are going to be news managers who are not comfortable with it either. But there's something else that I've confronted in journalists, which I think is interesting, that the ones who've gone off and done this remarkable work feel that in many ways the victims of war are the displaced people, those who've lost their homes, who've lost loved ones. And in relation to that degree of suffering, what right do they have as journalists to complain that they're feeling unwell? And many of them use that as the yardstick to judge their own complaints by. So they feel almost guilty, at times ashamed, that they could be having these kinds of feelings when their suffering in relation to what they've witnessed in war zones is so much less. And this is a message that I've heard time and time again from journalists who feel that it's a luxury for me to go and talk about my own distress when clearly what I've seen in other people is so much greater than what I've experienced. And of course, this is a distortion. On one level, they're correct, but it's a distortion in terms of their thinking. It shouldn't negate what they've been through. If a journalist has been held captive, if they've been subject to a mock execution, if they've been beaten up, if they've had a colleague killed, you can't dismiss those kinds of experiences as relatively inconsequential, because in comparison to what's gone in a war zone and the mass killing that they've seen around them, this doesn't rate. And that's a very dangerous distortion that creeps into some journalists' thinking and becomes a barrier in terms of their accepting help.
Are any of your people, and by that I mean people who you've interviewed or who you have treated, in great jeopardy now, either because they're in prison or kidnapped? Or,
to be honest, I don't know. What's been an interesting development of the website that we established to help frontline journalists is that the reach of the internet is so great, I now get correspondence from countries such as Somalia, etc., where journalists are in dire difficulty. Now, the exact nature of the stress that they're under is not known to me, but These are journalists who are often reaching out in extremis. Those are very difficult situations to deal with, because how do you provide assistance to someone who is in a society where, you know, medical services have collapsed, etc.? So that becomes a challenge. But I'm sure that there are journalists who have used the website, who've sent emails to me, who at this very moment are in considerable danger.
You know what I think about sometimes? Like, it's one thing to cover a war and put your life at risk in order to cover it. When you know that people are paying attention to what you write and that they're paying attention to the war that you're covering. But some journalists are risking their lives to cover wars that aren't on the front pages, that are in places that, you know, people aren't paying that much attention to. And that must make it even harder.
I think that's right. I mean, I've had journalists tell me that time and time again, how difficult it is to go and witness something and report it and to know that their photographs or their stories are not going to get much attention. I think what the very experienced journalists often do in a situation like that is that they still record what they've seen, either with camera or with their words, because they want there to be a record, a historical record. It might not make the newspapers, it might not make the 9 o'clock news, but at least there will be a record of what's taken place over there. So they're bearing witness. And I think a number of journalists find that to be a very important motivating factor, and one that in some ways offsets their irritability or their frustration that their story is not really going to make it into the consciousness of people back home.
Dr. Feinstein, thank you so much for talking with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Anthony Feinstein is the author of Journalists Under Fire. He's a professor of psychiatry at the University of Toronto. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Anne-Marie Baldonado. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, as the Supreme Court takes its summer recess, we look back on the court's decisions this term and look ahead to what faces Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor, with Adam Liptak, who covers the court for the New York Times. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.